We are now recording the audio. So welcome all to the October 7th Q&A. Just as the normal housekeeping, we are recording and that will go up along with the slides to the website probably later on tonight or the latest tomorrow. We have quite a few things that are in the queue, but by all means use the chat window or unmute yourself, and I'm going to mute all right now. So, Alan, you will have to unmute yourself. So feel free to unmute yourself if you have something to contribute, or you could use the chat window. And with that, I think I will toss it over to Alan to lead us through the deck as we have it so far.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Do we have my title slide?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good. Well, welcome, everybody. And as Chris said, we do have a number of things. So, again, it's quite varied, so I hope everybody finds it of interest. I just mentioned the idea that the club is thinking of giving Zoom conferences, video conferences, on specific issues. These will be longer ones, probably an hour and a half sort of thing, like the library sessions. If you're interested in any of these or something that we haven't posted, check out the webpage. And certainly, if you have friends, relatives, colleagues who bug you incessantly for help on various issues, get them to take a look at this webpage and maybe they will suggest some things which they'd like to see. So anyway, off we go. The first thing we have is a follow-up on Office blocking files, and that was Chris's issue, and I think he has some further thoughts.
Yeah, I brought this up a week or two ago, on, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, on Q&A, where if you downloaded an Office file type, like a Word document or PowerPoint slides or Excel file, and you download it from the internet, if you double-click the file to open it, you got an error message saying it couldn't be opened. And I showed how you could unblock it by using the properties of the file. And I said that the thing we'd have to really do is just wait for Microsoft to actually fix the problem. So next slide. Or advance, yeah. Turns out Microsoft has fixed the problem. And so as of yesterday, I guess it was, or the night before, I got an update from Microsoft for Office 2019. And sure enough, it fixed it. And now when you open one of those files, you get what you see on the slide there, where it comes up, says protected view, be careful, and you have an enable editing button right there. So it no longer prevents you from opening the file. And for anybody who's interested, the fixed version is version 16.0.13231.20.262 is the version I got that actually fixed it, and it's the same version number through all the Office apps.
Okay, very good. And a kind of a follow-up and a share, talking about secondary administrator's account.
Yeah, I wanted to go through this again because I rushed it a little bit last time, and I forgot to mention one really key step in the end of the entire process. So the recap on it is that it's really important to have some kind of rescue account in Windows that is an administrator-level account, in case you get into issues with your current account. So if you have a single admin account on your computer and you do something like forgetting your password, or if the profile for that account gets corrupted, you could be locked out of your computer and you could lose all the data that's on that computer. So you don't want to do that. And so in order to create a rescue type account, if you go to Settings Account, and you go on the left-hand side there, the panel for family and other users. And in the other users section, there's a plus button and add someone else to this PC. So you click on that. And then ignore all of the things that Microsoft really wants you to do and go down to where it says, I don't have this person's sign-in information. And next. And again, ignore any prompts for putting in an email address or phone number or anything like that, and go to the option for add a user without a Microsoft account. And next. Then you get into the point where you can actually create this totally local account. It's not tied to a Microsoft account at all. And you put in an account name, you put in the password, and then you'll have three recovery questions that you have to put in. And I highly recommend that you do either of two things for recovery questions, is you either answer them honestly and then put some prefix or suffix on it that you always use for these recovery type questions. In this case, I use Q dash. And so somebody might guess that my first pet's name was Fido, but they would not know to put in the Q dash. So either do that or put in totally nonsense answers and then make sure that you record that in a place that you have access to. And that's the best way to deal with any recovery questions, whether it's on accounts on your local computer or whether it's recovery questions on websites to use. And next. And then after that, you will have that rescue account. Notice that it'll just say local account. It doesn't tell you the type of account it is. If you click on it, you'll get that change account type button. You click on that, and that's where you can actually change it to administrator and click on OK. And then you'll actually see the rescue account is listed as a local account, and it also says that it's an administrator account. If you don't see that word administrator on there, it's just a local account that is a standard user, and that's not what you want, because you want an account that can fix anything on the PC, including creating new accounts, accessing files anywhere on the computer, and so forth. So that was a step that I actually forgot at the last time I showed it, as making sure that you turn it into an administrator account once it's created. This whole process is also up on the Q&A website. So if you don't want to go through these slides, it's written up as an article on our website. And just a couple of other things on tips for protecting passwords. I wrote a couple of articles for the newsletter, and so there's a couple of them there. And then there is the list there for the Q&A website where this article, this series of slides has been written up as an article.
And just a further note on that, for people who are using password managers, Lawrence is indicating that he creates nonsense answers for security questions and records it in the password manager program. Actually, that's quite a good tip. I think most password managers will give you a field or a box where you can enter comments, and it's a great place to store things like that.
But in the context of this, because you may be having problem getting onto your computer, make sure that your password keeper is either on multiple computers or also on your phone or some other form, so that you're not locked into having to get onto the computer to get the answers on how to get onto your computer.
Good point, yeah. Okay, our next item is also a share, a tip on installing Windows 10, and this is from Bob Walker. I saw Bob there, so you want to talk to this, Bob?
Yeah, so a few days ago, I have an old computer that I'm wiping clean so I can donate it, and did a fresh install of Windows 10 using the Windows Media Creation Tool, which you can download for free. And it creates an installable version of Windows 10 that'll overwrite an existing version of Windows 10. I figured that was the quickest way to wipe the computer clean and put it in the condition I could donate it in. So one of the first things that I asked you is to set up an internet connection. So I put in the password for my wireless internet, and then you go along and go along. And in previous iterations of Windows 10, when it came to the part of setting up a Microsoft account, you could skip that. However, the latest version of Windows 10 doesn't allow you to do that. It wants you to set up a Microsoft account, come hell or high water. And so here I am stuck halfway through the install, And so I went to our other computer, Googled what I could do, and it basically said if you disable or if you disconnect your connection from the internet, it would skip that step for you. So I just went into the next room and shut off my wireless router for a few minutes, skipped through that step, got the rest of the process underway, and turned the router back on. Now, if the computer was hooked into your internet connection with a cable, you could just unplug the cable, but it allowed me to continue on with this. And, of course, at the end there, it was asking again, do you want to set up a Microsoft account? So I just said no or whatever. But it's annoying that in the latest iterations of Windows 10, you just can't skip this point. They definitely want you to have a Microsoft account. And another way Microsoft is annoying all their customers.
You have any more comments on that, Chris?
No, I think that's definitely sound advice, and I think it is good at least that Microsoft realizes that if you don't have an internet connection, you can't set up a Microsoft account, so defaults to being a local account. So I highly recommend that when you set up a new version of Windows, that you do set it up with a local account first. Two local accounts, your normal one that you're going to use, as well as that rescue type account. If you then later on want to turn it into a Microsoft account, you can do so. There are some other advantages that I won't go into here. If you start with a local account and then turn it into a Microsoft account, there are a couple of other advantages that occur too.
If I may, in all the computers that I set up and from a professional basis, I guess it's funny, everybody talked about this, but right from the get-go, what I've done is when I'm presented with the dialogue to say, hey, log into a Microsoft account, at the bottom left is join a domain. I click on that, and then I go through the process of setting up a local account. And that's it. So it's funny that isn't discussed more often, and maybe that's just with the Windows 10 Pro version. I don't know if that, obviously you don't have that option with Windows 10 Home.
Yeah.
So that's a good point.
You can't join a domain with Home.
So that would my advice that I put in the chat will only work for Windows 10 Pro.
Okay, our next share is from Chris.
Yeah, I came across this. I read The Cuckoo's Egg way back in the 90s, I guess, and I just came across this. There's actually available a Nova episode that I think was made in about 1990. On The Cuckoo's Egg, and it's really quite a fascinating tale for anybody who wants to read into a little bit about hackers in the early days of the internet. And it's Clifford Stoll is quite an entertaining read, and he figures very prominently in this Nova episode as well. So anybody who's interested, it's about an hour long and fairly low resolution. But other than that, it's an entertaining watch.
Yeah, it's a great story. Stoll was a physicist who was out of a job, and they gave him a task to find out why the accounts didn't match for the internet accounts. It was out by a few cents, so he was going through the code and found it wasn't the code at all, and then eventually tracked it down to international hacking. It's a fascinating story. Okay, so moving right along. Somebody has bought Office 365 for family so they can install it on two computers at least. The question is, if Outlook is installed, the Microsoft email client, will that affect Simpatico email? Right now, the individual goes to Dell.net, enters an email address and a password, in order to access webmail. So Chris, our email guru.
Yeah, there would be no effect at all. So if you use a web browser to access your Bell Mail, you can happily have Outlook installed. You could set up Outlook to actually access your Bell Mail if you wanted, but if you like the way you're currently accessing it just through a web browser, there'd be no conflict at all.
Okay.
Just a comment maybe on that. I'm not sure, but if you have, if you access your emails on Outlook, you won't see them again in the web. Do they get downloaded like locally type of thing, or I'm not sure.
Yeah, it depends on your settings. If you could set it up as Simpatico allows you to set up either POP3 or IMAP for access. POP3 by default will download and delete them from the web or the server. So when you go on the web, they won't be there. You can change that default so that it will never delete them or will only delete them after a month or things like that. You can set up various options on it. If you set up IMAP, it'll synchronize between your computer and the server, and what you see locally will also be seen through a web browser.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the first question of the night is from Bob Walker, I guess, setting up his new computer. In older versions of Windows 10, he could choose default apps by file type. And then when he selected a file extension like text, he had a number of choices. One was whatever program Microsoft thought was the best option to open text files. He could choose other installed apps that Microsoft knows would open text files. Or number three there, he could look for an app on his computer and choose one that he wanted. Or finally, number four, he could look for an app in the Microsoft Store. Now, he's got the latest update of Windows 10, it's version 2004, and the third choice, looking for an app on the computer, isn't there anymore. And the problem is he uses PFE, Programmer's File Editor, as a text editor. That's not in the Microsoft Store, so he can't choose it. So the question is there some way around that limitation? And this is what should happen. On my laptop's running Windows 10 version 2004. So if I open Windows Explorer and right-click on a text file, then I get this context menu, and I can choose Open With, and it gives me a bunch of choices, but I also have the option down the bottom there, circled, choose another app. And if I do that, then again, it will start off with a list of programs that Microsoft knows will open text files. And I already set it to run Notepad++, which is my favorite text editor. But basically, you can choose one of those things. If you hit the check the box, always use this app to open text files, then they open in Notepad++ forevermore sort of thing. However, if you don't want whatever's on offer, you can scroll down that list, and I get to a choice that says more apps. And if I click on that, I get down to a point where I can find that, look for another app on this PC. And then when I select that option, it basically opens Windows Explorer. I can browse through the various executable folders and find a program. And this happens to be an HTML editor. It would open text files. And it's kind of a text editor, a very specialized one. But basically, you can browse through the file system and find a text editor that's on your system that you want to use. Now, here's Bob's problem, so I'll let Bob talk to this.
Yeah, I tried that on this new PC, and of course it behaves somewhat differently. And in some cases, if you have a computer that's been running Windows 10 for a few years, even though it's not the same version of Windows 10, it may behave differently, or just different makes and models of computers. There's some slight differences depending on the hardware. So there's another way of doing this.
But don't despair, Bob. If you look at the quote there from the Microsoft website, they're using machine learning to intelligently roll out new versions of Windows 10 and deliver you a smooth update experience. You've got that to look forward to.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, the way I poked around on the internet there for a bit, and I found this other solution. And so you open up File Explorer and navigate to a folder that contains one or more of the file types that you want to change the default app for. At the top of the Explorer window, click on the View menu at the top and select Details. And so the file type you'll have the files listed in text down it. And on the right-hand side, there should be a column showing the file type and whatever. So you right-click on the file type for the file in question. In this case, it's a text file. And you select Open With, then choose another app. And similar to the process Alan outlined there, you'll be presented with a How Do You Want to Open This App window. So you scroll down again, same sort of procedure. Click on More Apps, and then scroll down to look for another app on this PC. And find out where the executable for that app is. And click on that and then hit the Open button. And this will launch the app with your file loaded. So to set this as the default, you repeat step number 3, and this time your app will be listed amongst the other apps and under How Do You Want to Open This App window. And so you click on the Always use this app to open whatever type of files it is, and then select your app, and then you're done. It's a bit more roundabout than Alan's way, but depending on what your computer comes up with, it's another way of doing it.
Yeah, it seems though there's lots of roundabouts, because Chris has got some thoughts on those lines.
Yeah, I found that in true Microsoft fashion, things can be variable. So I tried right-clicking on a JPEG file. I get an Open With that has a flyout menu that includes apps that are already known to be able to handle JPEGs, and I can go down through that entire process. On a PPTX file, so PowerPoint, I get Open With, but it doesn't have a flyout. But if you do the Open With, it basically works the same way. And then if I right-clicked on a file that had no file extension, I get the Open With without a flyout menu, but I will still get to look for another app on this PC. So some prompts may differ, but all of them seem to lead to a place where you can actually do that. Now, I also went in to look at, how can you go about doing it other ways? So if you go to the Settings app, you can go to Apps, Default Apps, choose Default Apps by file type, and you can select a given file extension. But as it turns out, if you go through it this route, you only get the list of apps that Windows thinks can handle that particular file type, or the ability to, say, find another app in the store. But it doesn't give you the option then to be able to search your local computer for file types that could handle it. So that's a little bit of a brain dead way of going about it. And There we go. Control Panel also has the ability to set file associations. And so you can go to Control Panel, Default Programs, Associate a File Type or Protocol with the program, and it just immediately switches you over to the Settings app. So that brings you back to the previous slide where you don't have an ability to select a particular program that's on your PC. Then I dug a little bit deeper, and I knew that in the, you could actually edit the registry and actually do this. Please note, I'm not recommending that anybody actually do this. If you do things wrong in the registry, you can definitely mess things up. And I actually came across a little bit of an oddity that I'll mention in just a little bit that is really why I don't think is a good idea to do it. But HKEY classes root is where file associations are actually defined. So if you go to HKEY classes root, you can see here, this was actually an Alan's screenshot where he has TXT file. And if you look underneath the shell, right at that key, it has a friendly type name. And it actually says, go to system root, which is wherever Windows is installed, normally C:\Windows, and then system32 and notepad.exe and %1, so it passes the file name to that, to notepad, which will then open the file. But this is a little bit weird because I never saw friendly name type anywhere on my system. So I tried something a little bit different. I renamed a GIF file to testgif.qwerty1, knowing that QWERTY1 is not a defined file type on my computer, guaranteed. So I did the right-click in File Explorer and did Open With, and I selected IrfanView from the list of programs that were presented there. So then I went back into RegEdit, and I looked at what was actually created for QWERTY1 file type. And next slide. And so we go down to under computer HKEY classes root, and I look for .QWERTY1. So it lists all the file extensions at the top as dot and the file extension. And I could see that there's only one value there. Its value name is default. The type is regsize. And the data of it is QWERTY1_auto_file. So then I scroll down the list of file types down to QWERTY1_auto_file, and then I can go down into shell, open, and command, and I can then see that, yes, indeed, I have a default value name with a value type of regsize and the value data being IrfanView's executable with the %1 passing that particular program or that particular file to IrfanView to actually open it up. Now, why I say this is not a good idea to do. First off, if we look back at Alan's example, and he actually had a friendly type name. I've never seen that anywhere on my computer. Secondly, I decided after I was done on this that I would actually just delete the keys that had gotten created for QWERTY1. So .QWERTY1 as well as QWERTY1_auto_file. I just deleted those keys, and to my surprise, when I went back out, I saw that my QWERTY1 file still had the icon for IrfanView. And I did a restart, and it still had the icon for IrfanView. And I double-clicked on it, and it opened in IrfanView. And so there were other places in the registry somewhere that were telling it still that IrfanView was what would handle .QWERTY1 files. And I did a search of the registry, and sure enough, I found some other registry entries that pointed to that, and I didn't understand them at all, and I'll leave them there, and they won't do any harm as long as I don't have a QWERTY1 file on my computer that I double click on. Nothing is going to happen, but generally speaking, definitely it's HKEY classes root was the intended purpose of file associations, but it looks like it's actually more complex than that. So if you play around with it, you do so at your own risk.
Which is a typical issue for a registry, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, our next question I think comes from B. He says to do backup. Every time she starts it, it asks for permission to make changes to the computer. And she asks, is that normal? Doesn't sound normal to me, but Chris is the to-do backup guy.
Yeah, and I think this is going to happen with all backup programs. And it is normal behavior for a backup program. Whenever you run a backup on your computer, you may define a backup set that includes files that other people or your normal account maybe even doesn't have access to. A typical example to that might be that, I'm going to have that on my next slide there, so I'll just talk to this one. So in order to ensure that the backup process can access every file on that computer, then it always will run as an administrator. So it's just built into the program itself. So next slide. An example of this is that if you have multiple users on your computer, you do not normally have access to their user profile directory. Even if you run as administrator, you elevate yourself to administrator, you don't actually have access to their documents, pictures, and things like that on the computer. You could actually take control of them and give yourself permission, but your account, even as administrator elevation, you don't have access to it. But if you do a backup on your computer, you want to make sure that not only your files are backed up, but all of the other user files are backed up as well. So long and short on it is, backup programs will always run as an administrator with actually extra privileges. They actually run with the backup privilege, and that gives them the ability to backup and restore any files anywhere on the computer.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting comment. I hadn't actually thought about other users' files. I of course run Mac and Reflect as my backup software. I usually run it as a regular user. So when I run the program, it does bring up the user account control, ask the permission. But I always thought that was because it needed the enhanced rights. But maybe you're right. Maybe even if I run it as an administrator, it would still pop up because it would need to get to other users' files. Okay, moving along. This is a question came in quite recently from Jocelyn. He wants to send a folder of files, but he wants to protect it. So he thought he would zip the folder, and add a password. Now, Windows 10 has a built-in zip process, and he can use that. And then he found a way to protect the compressed file. So he creates the zip file and then uses different software, I guess, to protect it. But this software he's using creates a key file, and you have to send that with the compressed file. And then that has to get installed somehow, and he thinks that might be too complex for the people he's sending the stuff to. So then he tried 7-Zip, which has a built-in option to add a password. But then when he checks to see if he can open the password-protected zip file, Windows opens it without asking for the password. But now he's asked for the password every time he opens any kind of file. So any suggestions? Well, I have one suggestion. I've been using a utility called pzip for a while. I think I was using WinZip earlier. I forget why I stopped using that, but something wasn't working the way I wanted it to. I've been using pzip happily. It seems fairly straightforward. I don't normally use a password on it, so I just ran it quickly to see what would happen. So I created a temporary folder, dropped a couple of text files inside the folder, and then told pzip to add these two files to a zip file. And if you notice on the right hand side, over in this area right here, there's a lock symbol that says enter a password. If I click on that, then it brings up this dialog box and asks for a password, and then I have to confirm that password to before I can say okay. So I say okay. And so now it's created my my zip file with these two text files inside it. So now if I double click on the zip file in order to open it, interestingly enough, it doesn't ask me for a password to open the zip. It shows me the contents, these two text files that I have in there. However, if I try and open one of these, if I double click on sitemap, for example, here, then bingo, I can't actually look at that file until I enter the password. And when I enter the password, then the file opens in Notepad++. It's simple text, and that seems to work quite well. Now, I'm not sure whether that's good enough for what Jocelyn wants or whether he wants to hide the entire contents, in which case you would need a program that would put the password on the zip file and then not allow anything to open the zip file until you gave it the password.
Actually, there's a way around that, Alan, and this has been an ongoing issue actually with zip. The actual structure of it in terms of encryption and so forth is that it allows you to see the directory, period. And there's no way around that. But what you could do is encrypt a zip file and then create an encrypted zip file of that. And so if you didn't want people to be able to see the actual contents, you know, you create one encrypted zip file and then you create a zip file that contains it. And all you'll see is that one encrypted zip file, which you can't then delve down into. So that's one workaround that I've used in cases where I thought that even the file names were sensitive. And so just basically double zip it.
Okay. Yeah, I would use something like ActScript to do that. It's a very simple file encryption program, and it works extremely well. But it gives it a .axx extension. So as you say, if you want it to keep it as a zip file, you'd have to re-zip it and create a double zip, as it were.
Yeah. I use Total Commander as my file manager, and it includes the ability to deal with zip files, including encrypting them. And so I've always I've used Total Commander for probably 15 years or more, and so I've always used Total Commander to do my zipping, and very easy to tell it to add a password to it. And there's a number of algorithms that it understands as well. If I just look and see, say I'm just going to do a quick test here. So you can do ZIP 2.0, which actually is fairly low-grade encryption. You can do AES 128, AES 192, or AES 256 encryption. Any of those are very strong encryption. And so I've been very happy using Total Commander. Anybody else have their favorite way of encrypting files? Feel free to unmute yourself or throw it into the chat.
Just to jump in, I'm just like, I had the same experience also with the 7-zip, is that I could see all the content of the files, but given there are hundreds of files in that folder, and there is different subfolders and so on, so I was just trying to make sure that it was easy to use by people that are not very literate on computers, so that's why I was trying to think of password just the one zip file, but probably maybe what you suggested is to zip the zip. Might be a way to go around that.
Yeah, I'm really puzzled that you had where it was actually asking for the password on every file as opposed to the zip itself. Very, very weird that it does that.
Yeah.
I've never run into that before with encrypted zip files.
I was surprised. I thought it would be a simple matter, but turned out that that's not so simple. Anyway, Microsoft has its own way also to encrypt the whole thing, but you have to have a separate file, and then you have to send that file with the zip to in order to unprotect the content?
Well, actually, it's standard zip, so you should be able to use File Explorer, like however you do whatever program you use to create an encrypted zip file. Somebody with just File Explorer should be able to decrypt.
Yeah, if you are using the Microsoft, the Windows 10 only, without using a third-party software, it has a different process. It's a more complex process.
Well, if anybody has any other suggestions, put them in chat or send them to us by email. You can always pass them along. I'll do a follow-up next week.
Thank you very much for your help.
Okay, our next question is about a 1 terabyte hard drive that's become very slow to access and for transferring files. Check disk has been run but doesn't improve anything. So the question is, has anybody had that problem and is there a solution? Now, if you have a solution, you have to unmute your mic. I'll put it in the chat. I don't think I have any bright ideas for this one.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Is the access and transfer a problem with the Western Digital drive itself, or is it a problem with the computer it's installed in?
It's just the Western Digital drive that has the problem. The rest of the drives on the computer work just fine.
Okay, but hang on a second. Have you tried the Western Digital on another computer?
Yes, I have. And I use the file manager I use is called ZTree. It's a 32-bit version of the old Xtree Gold. And it was, no matter what I did, normally it's very, very fast. But even in Explorer, just to go to a folder on the drive, a large folder, it took about 3 minutes just to open the folder.
Regardless of which computer you're using.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I tried it on a friend's computer, my computer. I don't know what it is. It's just very, very slow to access. I copy files. I tried to copy backup some files, and it backed up at the rate of about 2.6, 2.5 megabits per second. That was the best it would do.
Wow.
Bill Van Dyke is suggesting there might be a diagnostic program on the Western Digital website. Have you thought about that?
I tried. I looked. They didn't have anything at all, diagnostics. I was wondering if I should just – I was going to format it, just reformat it, NTFS, and I reformat it but not do a quick format. Do a proper format so it rewrites the sectors, right, blah, blah, blah. Would that make a difference, sir?
It could. What I would actually recommend is you go even further. I would delete the partitions on it, create a brand new partition, and then format the partition. The major difference you'll get between formatting and a quick format is a quick format won't check any of the surface structured, it won't check the surface quality and lock out any bad sectors, so it'll just create the equivalent of the file allocation table.
I should add to this that the drive was working fine. I got it from a friend. I used it for about a month, and all of a sudden this started. When I tried running the check disk and with the checks, you know, check for bad sectors, like do a scan, the old scan disk thing on it.
Yeah.
After a day and a half, it was still running. It was going up.
I'm wondering if you might have an actual physically failing drive. But, you know, I think it's certainly worth a try of deleting the partitions on it, create a brand new partition, and then format it. But if it still does the same thing, I personally would just throw out the drive at that point, I think.
Yeah, I use disk part, right? So it's just the disk part to do that?
Yep.
Partition?
Yep. Yeah, you can do it there. Or you can do it right from File Explorer, right-click on the drive. Or I guess to do the partitioning, you'd have to go into disk management. So if you right-click on the start button and go to disk management, you'd be able to do all your partitioning there as well.
Oh, I can. I don't have to do the disk disk part commands.
No, you can do it from computer or from disk management within Windows. So a graphical user interface, it'll let you deal with all the partitions that you've got, get rid of them, and then create a new partition and then format it.
Okay. Is there a disk part equivalent to the old FDisk/MBR master boot record? Just rewrite the master boot record.
I don't know. Does anybody else know?
Is this the hard drive on the? Is this a system drive on the computer?
No, it's not a system drive. It's a drive that I use. I used for auxiliary drive. It's connected to a little USB, caddy. It's either way. I don't use it as a system drive. I use it for backups and for movies and whatnot.
You don't want to rewrite the master boot record because that's the one that's driving your system.
No, I know. But in the old FDisk routine, it would just refresh the MBR. It wouldn't actually rewrite it. Unless you had a virus. If you had a boot sector virus, your disk would be gone because the boot sector virus migrated the MBR and then it was lost forever. But either way, I should just basically repartition it. Is that what you're thinking?
Personally, I think that's your best bet at this point. But I strongly suspect that it's going to be doing the same thing. I think you actually have hardware problems on the drive itself, and I don't think there's going to be any fix for it.
But thank you.
It's worth a try.
I had a suspicion that was a problem. So. Yeah. I think you're probably just confirming my suspicion. I'll hack away on it, but thanks for the advice. Yeah, the idea is repartition it if that's the guy that's toast.
I think
so. A couple of things in the chat window which might help you. Bill Van Dyke has posted a link to the Western Digital Diagnostic Program, so you could try running that and see if it tells you anything. And Jocelyn did a Google search which suggests that these kind of slowdowns are because the drive is starting to have bad sectors. And that gives you a big log file. And sometimes that isn't recognized.
And that might be why it took a day and a half and it still wasn't complete when I told it to check for bad sectors.
Yeah, that could be.
When you get a 1 terabyte drive and it's doing a sector check, it does take a while, that's for sure.
I know you said that you ran the check disk, but the check disk has different switch or different options.
Maybe I ran the check disk with the option to scan for bad sectors.
Okay.
So that automatically that implies the F switch. I already ran it with the F switch to fix.
Yeah.
And that took a long time, so I decided to do it with a switch to. Check disk and then the other switches, right? I do it by command prompt because I was kind of bored in DOS and stuck there somehow.
And just to put this forward, I don't have any experience using this, but how about Steve Gibson's grc.com? He sells a program called SpinWrite. It'll diagnose your hard disk.
I was going to ask you about SpinWrite, but the SpinWrite is such a powerful tool. It would take a week to run our 1 terabyte hard drive.
Okay.
It's also expensive.
I was going to ask you about SpinWrite, but I was afraid it would take a week because it goes right to the quantum level. That's a wicked, wicked program.
I think SpinWrite is probably costing you more than the value of the drive.
Probably. You're right. Good points.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I just bought a 2 terabyte Western Digital hard drive at Amazon.ca, and it was less than $70. The 1 terabytes were about $15 cheaper than that. So, if SpinWrite's going to cost you more than that, there's your cheapest alternative.
And I save a week. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I remember SpinWrite. I had actually a copy once, a licensed copy. But that was back in the 540 megabyte maximum disk days, like we're talking 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's going back some.
Yeah, it was. But even then, it would take a day to run an 80 megabyte drive. Because like I said, it goes down to the quantum level. I was really obsessed with hard drives. It's anyway, I'm babbling, but I've got the point. Thanks a lot for your advice. I'm going to go check this link out that somebody sent me.
Okay, so that's the end of our prepared questions. So now we're in that. Any other questions or stuff you want to share?
If nobody else has something, what I could do is I really like using Total Commander, and let me just go ahead. I'm going to do a share screen on my Total Commander, and I will show how it can be used for creating encrypted zip files. So the thing I like about Total Commander is that it's a two-panel one. I could just have from one side to the other. So if I want to move files from one location to another, copy them, or things like that, very easy to actually just, you know, go and select a different drive, and I can just go up and down the directory tree and things like that to get wherever I want to. But in the context of this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show how easy it is to actually create an encrypted zip file. So if I just take a couple of JPEGs here, and I select them by just hitting the insert key or shift down arrow, and I can select them, they turn up in a different color, all customizable with colors and things like that. If I go onto the file menu, I get an option there to do pack. Oh, are you folks seeing a box in the middle called pack files?
Yep.
Oh, good. I thought this was going to disappear. We had that happen with File Explorer before. So if I say pack files, it's going to assume the other directory over on the right-hand side as the destination, and it just calls it according to the directory name that you happen to be in at the time. But you can change it to anything you want. So I could come in here and say I want to call it onetemp.zip just so that it sorts to the top of the list. And then I have an option here to encrypt. And so when I click on OK, it comes up with, I can choose the encryption type that I want, and then I put in the password. So if I put in pass, hit enter, ask for it again, just to make sure I know what I'm typing, hit OK, and it has now created this encrypted zip file. And zip files can be handled just like a directory. So if I hit enter, I go into that, and again, I'm seeing that directory of the files that exist in there, but I can't actually access the file. If I try to access the file, I get the close and execute. If I try to read it, then it'll come up and it'll, or copy it out or anything, then I'll end up getting that prompt. Okay, and then I can just put in the password, and then I can say remember until the program is closed or minimized. I can click on OK, and then it opened that file. So very, very easy to deal with zip files, whether they're encrypted or not, using Total Commander. But it's a great overall program for any sort of file management. It can do FTP file transfers. It can do tons of things on there. So really nice program. It's available as a shareware type thing. If you don't pay for it, you get a nag screen that comes up every time you start the program. Just says press 1, 2, or 3, and it gives you 3 buttons, and then that's it until you close the program. It operates fully. And if you pay for the program, other than the good feeling that you're supporting the author, that's the only thing that changes, is you no longer get that prompt for to press on button 1, 2, or 3 when you start the program.
One of the options I saw in the menu is self-extracting. I wonder if it would be...
Yeah, you can do that too. Yep, you can do that too. So if I take these two files again, and if I go into here and I go pack, and then I'll create a self-extracting archive, and let's encrypt it as well.
And oh, we'll the option disappeared.
Oh, did it? Oh, okay. So you can't do self-extracting. Okay, that's good to know. So I had never actually tried doing that. So let's go back into pack, and let's just do it as a self-extracting archive. And it's interesting that it's mutually exclusive. So if I click on OK, so now it's created it. And then There it is right there, temp.exe. So if I run it, it comes up with a prompt. Do you see the prompt on screen?
No.
No, okay. There is a prompt on screen that, because I'm sharing just the application window, it's not, it's a separate application running now. And it's self-extracting zip file and asks me where I want to unpack them to. And it will just go ahead and do the unpack at that point. So, yeah, it just creates an executable. So, yeah, unfortunately, it would be nice if they included the ability to do the encryption on that as well, but looks like that's not available.
You know, Bob Walker here. I just want to back up Chris on this. I've been using Total Commander for about as long as he has, because he's the one that showed it to me originally. And for those who remember back in the DOS days, the old Norton Commander, when Windows came out, instead of upgrading the Norton Commander to be a file manager for Windows, they came up with this god-awful Norton desktop thing, which was just a horrible thing. And so this guy, Christian Geisler, sort of took the idea of the Norton Commander, and he originally called it Windows Commander, but somebody raised a stink about that, so he renamed it Total Commander. But it's what Norton Commander would have probably morphed into if Norton had have continued to develop the tool. So it's quite customizable on what you see, how it works, and everything else. And it's a really good program. In fact, I only use File Manager when I have to, and otherwise I use Total Commander for all my file management.
I'll put it into the chat window where you can get it if you're interested. So gizler.com is the website for it. So do we have any other questions or shares or cautions or kudos for a service you like or anything at all?
Yeah, Bob Walker here again. For the last many years, I've been using Adobe there to open up PDFs and all that, and there's all those issues with security and heavy resource usage and all that. So finally, I broke down when I was setting up this new computer, and I used a program that Alan and Chris both recommended called Foxit. PDF reader, and of course I installed it, and the very first PDF I opened looked like hell. The letters are running into each other and everything else. What kind of garbage have they recommended here? So I went and opened up a bunch of other very complex PDFs, and they were all fine. So, you know, I wanted to check this out a bit further, so I took the file that didn't open properly and took it over to another computer that was running the Adobe, which is sort of the holy grail of PDF readers, and opened it. And sure enough, in Adobe, the file was corrupted as well. So kudos to Alan and Chris for recommending a very good freeware program here that does exactly what it should do, which is show the PDF the way it should be shown.
There really is no excuse for a PDF reader not to do a good job. Although it is proprietary, the specification for how you read a PDF file, Adobe has made it public. And so there's absolutely no excuse for any other company to do a bad job of reading PDF files, that's for sure.
Can I just note, Bob, that I've actually moved on from Foxit. I got tired of it always bugging me to update it. So I went to PDF Exchange Viewer, which is another open source product, or freeware product anyway, which works extremely well and doesn't bug me at all.
And it's Canadian author too.
And Micheline says, I use PDF Exchange Viewer, which I reviewed years ago. There you go. So there's all kinds of reviews in the OPC UG newsletter. Just then's put a question anybody from Meetup, OPCUG now has a Meetup webpage, and we're advertising our meetings. So the question is anybody on the call tonight came from the Meetup website? You want to put a note in chat identifying yourself, that would be very helpful. Yeah, and with that, we're coming to the end of the time, so I guess I'm going to just give a couple of announcements. Next week is the club's main monthly meeting for October. And for those of you with Android phones, you may find the presentation of interest. We're going to talk about how Android works and what you can do with your phone in terms of third-party apps and the file system and all kinds of wonderful things. And the next Library Tech Cafe, Lawrence is going to be talking about scam avoidance in Trust. But that's not until the 23rd of November. The next Q&A session will, of course, be next week after the main presentation. So it will be around 9 o'clock, I guess. If you have questions, or you can answer any of the questions that we post, or topics that you want to share, then please send them to us at suggestionbox@opcud.ca. And thank you very much for attending. That's everything from me.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good rest of your evening.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.